Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Arsenal Özil, marca Mesut Özil. Lo da, Liniers, gol del Arsenal, remonta el Arsenal, Giroud, marcó Giroud.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra. As always, with James from Gunnerblog, a goodly first morning of the Premier League season to you.
Goodly first morning of the Premier League season to you too. And what a weekend it was. Did you watch a lot of it?
I watched, obviously watched us and then I watched Match of the Day. I was sort of around on Saturday, flicking in and out of some of the football, watching. I was sitting actually on Saturday afternoon playing FIFA, career mode on FIFA, bemoaning the fact that Glenn Kamara and Jeff Rennie-Adelaide are the two central midfielders. In the transfer window, Arsenal have gone out and they've bought Tolisso and what's the Schalke lad, Goretzka?
Oh, really?
Yeah, they bought those two and then they still play Glenn Kamara and Mohamed Elneny. And these guys who spend... Anyway, look, I was sitting there playing that and watching some of the Chelsea game. It was quite entertaining, wasn't it? The weekend until yesterday, where it got spoiled a little bit, the first weekend of the Premier League season has been pretty enjoyable.
Yeah, the first couple of days were absolutely great. Yesterday, less so. But fortunately, yesterday I didn't really see much of it, so I didn't have to put up with that. And I mean, Friday night, we'll get onto, I'm sure, was absolutely exhausting. And then Saturday, I say it was brilliant. I'm only really thinking about one result, but that Chelsea result really couldn't have got the season off to a better start. I found that, frankly, hilarious.
Yes, I did too. I saw some people saying that the Chelsea fans were singing "Spend Some Fucking Money," which is
in poetry, isn't it?
I mean, really? Seriously? Oh, you can't help but laugh. I mean, you'd laugh anyway, but the lack of self-awareness there is really quite something. What did you make of the red cards? I thought Cahill is long overdue a red card, to be honest. I thought that was a tackle that absolutely thoroughly merited a red.
Yeah, I saw a bit of debate about that, and I couldn't really believe it. For me, it's a clear red card, and I think he's lucky he didn't cause an injury. I mean, Cesc, the second one, you know, he's a bit unfortunate, maybe, because I think he's going for the ball on that one. He's just a little bit late. It's just a bit of a Paul Scholesy, not very good tackle, isn't it?
Mm. But, you know, if you get a yellow card in the first half for sarcastically applauding the referee, you leave yourself open to that kind of thing. It was Eboué-esque, that kind of sending off, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the sending off of the weekend was actually last night. Did you see Ronaldo sending off yesterday?
I did see a bit of it, actually, on Twitter, but I had a couple of glasses of wine, so I've kind of forgotten. He got booked second yellow for diving, was that it?
Yeah, he came on, scored within a few minutes, a brilliant goal, admittedly, but was booked for taking his shirt off. That was his first yellow.
Well, look, everybody had to
celebration.
Everyone had to see his nipples, James. You know, he'd just scored. It was important that the world saw his nipples and his pectoral muscles.
Well, the world did see that, but what the world also saw was him getting a second yellow shortly afterwards for diving. So it was a quite extraordinary cameo. It wasn't the old Eboué sort of, you know, coming on and not surviving until the end of the game. But, yeah, look, that was my favourite sending off of the weekend. But the Chelsea ones were pretty good too. And I mean, they were 3-0 down at half-time. I mean, obviously, it's a bit disappointing. They clawed it back a little bit, put a bit of respectability on the scoreline.
No, that was the great thing. That was the best thing about it.
You enjoyed that part?
Yeah, because their fans would have been sitting there going, oh God, this could be one of the great comebacks of Premier League history, because you were 3-0 down and you're down to 10 men. You go, no, there's not much chance. And then, you get a goal. And it's like, could we? Because remember, 10-man Arsenal coming from 2-0 down to beat Bolton 3-2 a few years ago. That was really a brilliant comeback. And then they would have got the second goal and then thought, it's near, God, it could be brilliant, we could have something to talk about, and then just no, didn't happen in the end. They just couldn't get that final goal to get something from the game. So I prefer that they got back into it. I mean, look, if you'd ask me, would I prefer them to lose 6-0? Yes, of course. But in those circumstances, I like that there was a slight glimmer of hope that was then just taken away from them.
Yeah, I suppose so. That is a one sheen to put on it. And did you watch Liverpool as well? Their game was quite fun as well.
Yeah, I was watching bits of that, actually. I was out with my brother on Saturday afternoon, and he was following the game on his phone because we were out and about, we were doing some stuff, and he was like, oh, God, 1-0 down. Jesus. I was going, yeah, well, I know the feeling, man. Welcome back to the Premier League season. yeah, and I caught about the last half an hour of that. Seriously, they don't really do defending, do they, Liverpool?
No, not so much, especially at set pieces. So that was very entertaining as well. I mean, all in all, I'm choosing to take the positives and call that an excellent first weekend of the Premier League season.
Well, look, when you win on the opening day, something that is a bit of a rarity for us, it does give you a different perspective on things, doesn't it? Because you're not immediately firefighting. How worried were you? Let me ask you seriously. You know, how worried were you? Because I know I said this in the blog, but I was actually sitting there at one point. We were 3-2 down, heading into the final 10 minutes, and I was thinking, I don't know what to do now. I don't know how to talk about this. I don't know how to write about it. I don't know, like, can my heart deal with all the, just the fallout from another Arsenal defeat on the opening day? How do we even try and make any sense of it? And then, of course, it all turned around. But you know, how worried were you?
I mean, imagine the morbid atmosphere in this podcast if we were having to dissect another opening day defeat. I don't know if I would be able to do it. I think I probably would have just texted you and been like, I'm not doing it today.
Let's talk about something else.
Can we talk about something else, please? How long can we talk about Burnley for? I was really worried. And actually, what a huge moment it was to get that equaliser just before half-time, because I was even thinking, if we go in at half-time, 2-1 down, you'll hear those familiar boos ringing around the Emirates Stadium, and I just thought, oh God, deja vu, here we go again, more of the same. But thank goodness we got an equaliser then, and ultimately that didn't really shift the momentum of the game. We went out after half-time and conceded another relatively quickly, but I just think it protected the atmosphere in the ground a little bit from descending into real negativity.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. But it was just bizarre, wasn't it? At one point, as we're chasing the game, we have a team. Is it a team? How can you describe what was on the pitch at the time? Because we had a midfielder come wing back playing at right back, a right back playing at left back, two left backs at centre half, our record signing striker on the left wing, another striker on the right wing, Olivier Giroud, whatever. It was just bizarre, wasn't it? So many players out of position.
11 players. Yeah. And it was chaos, really. I mean, the tricky thing is, I was looking at it and going, this is a complete mess. And it just felt like we had players all over the pitch who didn't necessarily know that position or what they were supposed to be doing, and the formation had changed. And then it paid off. You know, Arsene Wenger's two changes kind of were the guys who turned the game around. And it was interesting watching it, because while those individuals made a massive contribution, it was difficult to look at the strategy and go, well, this is a coherent plan. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. It was literally just fucking throw as many forwards on as we could. It was a throwback to the old days of Arsene Wenger when we were chasing a game. It was throw on Kanu, Wiltord, Henry, Bergkamp, you have Ljungberg, Pires all on the pitch at the same time, and just go for it. I mean, it doesn't speak to, as you say, a coherent strategy, but needs must. I think we were desperate times calling for desperate measures. But let's maybe go back and try and review the game, because it started Well, I mean, I think we saw from the opening 5 minutes kind of what we were going to get from this game. Arsenal took the lead, and you're going, oh, this is fucking amazing. Lacazette.
That was great.
Yeah, because, you know, we'd been speaking about how it would be good for him to get off the mark quickly, to put that, you know, not get weighed down by the burden of not scoring, you know, as can happen with players. It might take a few games, but, you know, within 2 minutes, he scores, and what a very good header it was. And you're thinking, well, that's just the perfect start. And then, and then Leicester equalise within 2 minutes.
I know. And the equaliser looked pretty horrendous, didn't it? I mean, it was messy stuff from us. They had a big overload at the back post. I'm not entirely sure what Cech was doing. I guess he felt he had to intervene, but he didn't really make the best of it having got there.
No.
So that was pretty ugly and quite surprising, really, because despite stereotypes, I guess, our record at defending set pieces was actually pretty good, wasn't it, for pretty much the entirety of last season?
Yeah, I mean, we have been pretty good in that regard. And I thought, actually, you know, we did cope relatively well with their stokiness, you know, because they were flinging in long throws. I mean, they're dangerous just by their very nature, and they make you on edge, don't they, those long throws, because, look, they're difficult to defend. But I thought for the most part we did quite well. But certainly on that first goal, we weren't awake enough for a short corner, which I think has been a problem for us down the years more than once, hasn't it? That's something that catches us out. But, you know, Leicester...
It's not one of the zones we've accounted for. We've accounted for all the zones except the one except very near one. The corner flag.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, we had more of the possession, we had more of the ball, we had more of the chances, but certainly Leicester, every time they came forward, I think particularly in that first half an hour, looked really, really dangerous. They looked really threatening, and we, as a defensive unit, didn't look at all cohesive, which is not necessarily that surprising considering the state of the back three or back five. What did you make of that?
I mean, yeah, I was really surprised when I saw that, because I expected, to be honest, Arsene Wenger had seemingly said that Per Mertesacker was fit to play. I thought he was going to be in there. So when the teams came out and he wasn't part of it, I was a little bit surprised. I mean, what do you understand of that situation? Do you think that that's purely a fitness thing, a bit of worry about him after that head injury at the Community Shield?
Yeah, that's what I was told, because I did see Raphael Honigstein saying that Mertesacker was perfectly fit to play based on seeing him in training all week. But I did ask somebody about it, and they were concerned that, you know, one clash of heads or one header and he would open up a wound in which he got 12 stitches just 4 days ago. So I think that was the main problem with that. Otherwise, I can't think of any other reason why Mertesacker wouldn't have been involved, given the absences, given the fact Koscielny's not there, Mustafi wasn't fit enough, Gabriel's not injured, Callum Chambers is seemingly on the way out. I think we can draw that conclusion on a night where we have no real central defenders. He still wasn't even in the squad. So I think it was a fitness thing with Mertesacker. I don't believe that he was just left out. I think it was a concern over his head injury.
It would be strange, wouldn't it, to just leave the club captain out? I mean, I heard that he was disappointed and that he wanted to play, but you would expect that of Per Mertesacker, so I don't necessarily think it's any real cause for alarm. And actually, when I saw that starting lineup, I didn't consider it a huge cause for alarm, because that was the back three who played for the majority of the game against Chelsea and acquitted themselves very well. You know, we spoke after the Community Shield about how well Monreal did in that position at the heart of the three. Against Leicester, maybe that was exposed a little bit, and, you know, I guess the unfamiliarity of those players and maybe the lack of a commanding centre-half. You know, I felt the performance of Rob Holding, for example, was maybe a little bit influenced by the fact that he didn't have a senior centre-half like a Mertesacker or Koscielny alongside him. I thought there were a couple of moments in the game he could have done with, you know, a word in the ear, a bit of coaching, a bit of encouragement, and maybe that wasn't... That kind of vocal presence wasn't really there.
Yeah, that's true. And again, I was told after the game that somebody from the Leicester side had spoken to some people around the club anyway, and their plan was to pressurise our defenders to get Holding on the ball, because they thought he might be a little bit, not suspect, but certainly if you put him under pressure, then he's... he's so young as a centre half that that could be seen as an area of weakness. I'm not sure what his passing stats were in the end. I think I looked at it yesterday and he was around 81% passing pass completion rate, but certainly he had a difficult game. One of those where Arsene Wenger said afterwards that he's going to be a great centre half, but you know, young central defenders have games like this where it doesn't go right for them. And we've seen young central defenders have this kind of game before. Maybe perhaps a little bit worse than Holding was, and it has been damaging to them rather than educational. So you got to hope that the investment that they're making in Rob Holding and the confidence that they've shown in him by playing him in these games is something that he can take stock from. But obviously, it was a difficult night for him, and he's got to reassess a little bit and use it as a learning experience rather than it being one that's going to damage his confidence.
Yeah, I don't think he had a particularly great game. And if I'm honest, I saw a couple of signs of a bit of almost rustiness against Chelsea the week before. I do think that it's inevitable that Arsenal fans are going to fear the worst with centre-halves because we've been down this path so many times. We've talked about it, Senderos, Giroud, even Chambers to an extent, people who've shone and then not necessarily fulfilled that potential. But I do think Holding, from what we've seen, has maybe more to him than that. And I think, you know, it's important that they keep the faith with him. I can see the temptation almost to take him out the side, but I think you need to protect his confidence too. So I actually think he probably will be in a team next week at Stoke, and hopefully he'll be better off for it. But Jamie Vardy can be a real nightmare to play against, and it felt like he was pulling onto Holding and making it a difficult night for him. And you know, whatever you think of Vardy, he's a nightmare to face when he's like that.
Yeah, well, Vardy exposed the other two central defenders for the second goal. A bad pass by Granit Xhaka, a mistake from him in midfield, playing it into an area where there was no Arsenal player. Leicester took advantage. Very good cross, decent finish from Vardy. So you're 2-1 down and you're thinking, well, fuck, this is not going according to the plan that we had in the first 2 minutes where you thought, wow, this is going to be great. We'll get off to a good start. But a goal from Danny Welbeck, and I think what part of what summed up the system, if you can call it that, was the fact that the man who provided the assist, the man who was almost furthest forward in that penalty box, was Kolasinac. Is that what we're calling him now? I think it's Kolasinac.
I think so. Yeah. I think it's a hard C or at the end of it. Kolasinac.
I get so many emails about it. People going, you know, pronounce it like this. And then the video where he pronounces it Kolasinac. But anyway, Kolasinac, I think we'll go with. Will we make that the house pronunciation?
Kolasinac. Okay. I'll try and stick to it. I mean, I'd make no promises, but it's Chesney all over again, isn't it? At least this one's easier to spell. Yeah. Sid is a good one, actually. Like Ralph before him, you know, we've got to simplify it.
Yeah.
But he is obviously looking like a terrific addition. I have to say, his defending on the first Leicester goal was very suspect. He sort of started on the back post, wandered into the middle of the penalty area and left a couple of men behind him. But after that point, I thought he grew and grew. But he does look like a wing back, doesn't he? He does look like someone who wants to push on and get involved in the final third, which kind of belies his size and his physique because he's got the body of a centre half, but the attacking instincts of a wing back. But I think he showed that again. And actually, Mesut Ozil had a really weird game, I thought, but the pass from him in the build up to this goal was pretty crucial. It was one of those penetrative passes through the lines, initially to Lacazette. Kolasinac took it on. And we got the goal. And I can't have been the only Arsenal fan who, when the ball fell at Danny Welbeck's feet, thought, oh, what is going to happen here?
Well, there was an element. You know, it almost got stuck under his feet, but he dug it out and put it away. 2-2 at halftime, you're thinking, okay, that's better. That is better. That, you know, just we're not quite as in danger as we might have been going in 2-1 down, as you mentioned. But then, you know, you think, okay, come out in the second half and put what was wrong in the first half right. Put it right. Stay organized. Be defensively disciplined. And we were all over the place again. I think before Vardy scored his second goal, there was a moment where Petr Cech had to come miles out of his area and make what was in the end a very good tackle, but a good tackle predicated on the fact that Vardy's control wasn't quite right. I wonder what might have happened if Vardy had controlled the ball properly, because Cech was not going to get it that otherwise. But you know, he had to come out and He cleared it away. I mean, it was a good tackle, and he was obviously very alert and quick out of his area rather than off his line. But, you know, it was from that kind of passage of play, carelessness at the back, that led to Amara's shot that Cech tipped over for the corner from which they scored. So we were sloppy, I think.
Yeah, what do you attribute those, for example, that corner and the other set piece? Do you think that was poor defensive work? Do you think it was just a very good delivery? I mean, I'll be honest, I don't fully understand our defensive system at set pieces. I know it's been quite effective, but I don't quite understand the delineation of zonal versus man-to-man and how it's supposed to work. Because that one, it felt like the ball was dropped into such a dangerous area, and yet there was no real appropriate cover.
Yeah, there didn't seem to be somebody in that zone. I mean, conceptually, you look at someone like Granit Xhaka, for example, who I think probably should have done more when he saw Vardy's run. He obviously had his zone to defend, but I think he could have stood in Vardy's way, or at least made it more difficult for Vardy to get past him. You know, I think that's got to be part of it as well. I mean, it's a great header, but again, we've nobody on the back post. And I think it wasn't good defending at all. We've got to be a bit more alert than that when it comes to corners. But, you know, I wonder, can you put some of that down to first day rustiness? Can you do that? I mean, all of the goals.
I don't know about rustiness, but it felt like there was a lot of adrenaline in the game. You know, a bit of nervous tension, that thing of the eyes of the nation kind of being on us and desperately wanting to get that first win that eludes us so often. Mm. And I felt like there was some positives about that. It meant that there was a very exciting game and one in which Arsenal actually had some real vitality going forward at times, but there was a nervousness and a two, and I think you saw that defensively. You know, this wasn't a particularly controlled performance from either side.
No, it wasn't. Mildly. I mean, look, I thought it was very funny that people were focusing on our defending when Leicester, who are a team that basically want to sit back and defend and hit you on the counter-attack, conceded more than we did. So clearly that, you know, the counter-attacking part, they've got down very well because they scored three times, but the defensive side of their game is not up to scratch either. So I think it's going to be a common theme throughout the Premier League this season. We're going to see a lot of high scores, I think, because there's a lot of poor defending and poor defenders and poor defensive systems and teams that can't defend. So let me close my...
How do you feel about that? Do you mind watching that? Or are you like, hey, the more goals, the merrier?
When it's other teams, yes. I'm on board.
That's
with
the
that.
Golden rule.
Yeah. But for Arsenal, I would like us to be a bit more defensively solid, a bit more stout, a bit more organized, a bit more... what's the word I'm looking for? Just less inclined to give up stupid goals. And I think miserly is a good word. I think when you look at all the goals, all the three goals we conceded against Leicester on Friday night, they were all pretty much avoidable. So, you know, that's on one hand, that's a good thing. You can say, let's not give the ball away in midfield for them to take advantage. Let's defend properly from corners and set pieces. So you can see that those things, but on the other hand, you know, you should be doing those things anyway. These are not things where you go, oh, it's not a light bulb moment, right? This is what you should be doing. It's just part of your job. So,
Arsene Wenger span it that way. He sort of took it as a positive. He said all three goals are essentially preventable. I mean, the problem is not preventing them, but hopefully, let's be optimistic, we can iron that out over the coming weeks.
Right, so 3-2 down, and we're worried, we're sitting there, we're anxious, we're fretting, we're nervous, we're going, where is it going to come from, where is the goal going to come, what's going to happen?
We're all thinking, what we must do is switch Hector Bellerin to left-back in a 4-4-2. That's the answer here.
That was exactly it. But look, obviously, Mesut Ozil, you mentioned him in the build-up to the second goal, he had a good hand in the third goal, too.
Hey.
Had to be done, I'm sorry. Quite how much. Mike Dean,
there's been a lot of fuss
that.
Over that, hasn't there?
Yeah, but fuck it. Like, fuck that. You know,
I don't care. No. And also, there's quite a lot between that and the ball hitting the net. I mean, our defending, we've talked about, Leicester's defending on that set piece is really bad. When Xhaka clips that ball through to Ramsey, there's about three Arsenal players stood there who potentially put it in.
Yeah.
And look, we always loved Mike Dean. He's always been a friend of the podcast. So glad to see him, you know, stay on the good side.
Cheers, Mike. Yeah, you're a diamond of a man. But what a brilliant touch. I mean, firstly, what a brilliant pass by Xhaka with the outside of his foot. Secondly, amazing touch from Aaron Ramsey. There was a moment, I think, where Theo Walcott was going to go for it, and he obviously got the shout from Ramsey and backed off.
From your sofa, screaming.
Don't fucking do it, Theo! Leave it alone! Yeah. But Ramsey, I mean, fantastic touch and a really brilliant finish as well.
Incredible first touch. I mean, the ball was sort of dropping out of the air, and he kind of took it on the outside of his foot, and it was perfectly placed for him to put his foot through it and score the goal. I mean, I know you said, actually, was it you? I believe it was you who said that if you could keep one player fit this season, it might be Aaron Ramsey.
Yeah.
And when you look at our midfield and some of the issues with it, I do think it's really important that we have him available. And I would love, I mean, that goal was scored with the conviction that we saw from him, you know, back in 2014 when he was banging in goal after goal. And if he could even get up into double figures this season, it would be a big, big contribution.
Yeah, particularly as we can't defend for shit. So the more goals we have, the better. I think this could be our motif for the season. It's just score as many fucking goals as we can. You know, Ramsey, Ozil, Sanchez, Walcott, Iwobi, Giroud, Welbeck, Lacazette. This is how we're going to cope with our defensive frailties. But look, brilliant piece of football from Olivier Giroud. Well, a brilliant piece of football. Just a really nice layoff from Olivier Giroud to Lacazette, who almost scored, which led to the corner, which brought about the Giroud goal. Mm.
What a save as well. I mean, that got overlooked. He scored immediately afterwards, but that deflected shot from Lacazette, I don't know how Schmeichel kept that one out.
And just before we go on to that goal and the Giroud goal, I think it's worth pointing out that in the midst of our defensive hopelessness or haplessness at times, I think we played some really nice football. We played some beautiful football. There was a few moves in and around the penalty box. Danny Welbeck, I remember, putting, I can't remember who it was, Hector Bellerin through.
Bellerin, yeah. He probably should have scored.
Scored or squared it anyway. But, you know, I thought there was some nice football, despite the fact that a couple of players weren't quite as on it as you might like them to be. But there were a lot of positives from the football that we played, bar the defending. And then we have the Giroud goal. What can you say? What a header.
What a header. What a header. And Giroud, I mean, it's so curious, isn't it? At times you see him bundled over by a centre-half and you think, why aren't you being stronger? And then he scores that goal and you see the huge power he has. He's holding off, well, two defenders almost, really, who are arguably fouling him. And he uses his neck muscles, propels that into the far corner. I mean, that's what he can do. And it felt inevitable, didn't it? I mean, I saw people saying, even when we were trailing, don't worry, Giroud's going to come on and score. And he went and did it. I mean, I saw him interviewed after the game, and I think Gary Neville asked him, you know, you keep scoring off the bench, you probably like to start games. He almost laughed ruefully. He must know himself, look, this is working for me, and I'm delighted that he's staying. Really, really happy. I think it's definitely the right thing, and he's going to be a massive asset to the club going forward.
Yeah. And can I just say and I've seen it in the questions, a number of people saying that some time back on one of the podcasts, I was asked if I would sell Giroud, and I said, in a heartbeat.
I remember.
Yeah, and look, I was having a moment. I was depressed, you know, by what was going on at the club. It was probably in the middle of our terrible run, something like that. But I think throughout, I've always been a rigorous defender of Olivier Giroud's qualities at the club. I think he's a fantastic player, even if I've had reservations over whether or not he should be the number one striker. I think he's an incredible asset. There aren't too many forwards who can do what he did the other night. When you think about it, in the Premier League or in European football, there aren't too many around who can do what he did against Leicester, come off the bench, have that impact, but just to score that kind of a goal. So I was having a moment with Giroud. I apologise. I'm a big fan of his qualities, and I'm delighted that he's staying. He was given the chance to leave by Arsene Wenger, and he said, my heart and my soul told me to stay at Arsenal. So I think it's just evidence that your heart and your soul are better things to listen to than little boys.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also, you know, I think that the problem with Giroud, I think I remember you saying this at the time, is that you didn't necessarily trust Arsene Wenger to not start him every week as long as he was in the squad.
Yeah.
And Arsene seems to have got over that now. You know, I think especially with the acquisition of Lacazette. I think we're going to see Giroud starting less regularly. And he's found his perfect role in the squad as this super sub. You know, I wouldn't have anybody else coming off the bench. I think he's brilliant at that. He seems to absolutely thrive on it in a way that other players just don't manage to do. I think he enjoys it, actually. I think he wants to be starting games, don't get me wrong. But I think he likes coming on with that possibility of being the hero, you know. I think he revels in
that. That's true. And he is. I mean, he was the hero of Friday night. And I think during the season there's going to be plenty of football for him as well, particularly when we're looking at Europa League and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's great for him that he's decided to stay. Great for us as well, because he is a reliable goal scorer. He's a very good centre forward. And, you know, the more depth we have, the more options we have to score this season, the better. So, you know, we get into those final few minutes and I was thinking, Jesus, just don't do anything stupid now. Don't fucking Arsenal this, you fuckers. Yeah. And to be fair, we didn't. I mean, there were a couple of moments of mild threat from Leicester where they were chucking long balls in again. The Rory Delap guy was throwing in long throws, and Petr Cech plucked a couple of them out of the air, which helped ease some of the pressure. And in the end, we held on. An extraordinary way to start a new season.
Yeah, it is. And look, I think there were concerns in the performance, but really, I almost think the first game has to be viewed in isolation, and it is really about getting those points and kickstarting the season, because it plays such a distorted big role in kind of determining the mood around the club. Do you know what I mean? If you lose that opener, it just casts a shadow over everything right up until the transfer deadline. And I think getting the win was so vital that I'm not prepared to write it off fully, like some of the defensive mishaps, but I almost feel like now we've got a platform on which to build. We just had to get that first one out the way.
Yeah, absolutely. It was all about the points, however we got them. I mean, the idea, I mean, there's no point dwelling on it or trying to say what would have happened if we hadn't won, but given the record that we've got on the opening day down the last few years, given just the pressure that's on anyway this season not to do or repeat the same mistakes, it was hugely important. So, yeah, we'll have to see what happens, obviously, next weekend against Stoke. But we got the points, and really, that is the main thing. There are obviously some things that they need to work on, and hopefully they can do that. I don't think we're in any real position to make huge assessments, but I think it is important that we get some defenders back, some actual central defenders playing as central defenders as this season progresses, because I don't think you can get away with that kind of a makeshift back three / back five for very long. So a bit of stability and continuity there, I think, is going to be really important.
That's it. I think you can sort of throw it together and pull out a great effort for a one-off occasion like the FA Cup final. I think doing that in the longer term is more difficult. And I actually think as well, you know, we spoke about the centre halves, but I thought the wing backs didn't have particularly great games against Leicester, and I would really love to see Kolasinac at left wing back. So as soon as we get some centre halves back, I'd love to see that change made.
All right. So and just before we move on to part two and the questions, what did you make of Sky's decision to host their post match analysis pitch side rather than in the perfectly acceptable custom-made studio that's upstairs, which allows them to you know, to do things in silence? I thought it was quite funny at times. You could hear the Arsenal fans singing. My favorite moment, though, was Jamie Carragher he called Arsene Wenger arse.
Yeah.
Which, if you haven't heard it, here it is.
Every point you put against the second part of the table can cost you a lot.
It's not a commonly used nickname for the boss. I don't know how he would have felt about that, but I like the sort of assumed intimacy that Jamie Carragher went for there. The funny thing about the pitch side screening was that they weren't the only ones. So from my seat, I could see Jamie Carragher and Gary Neville there. And then 10 yards down the touchline, you had Robbie Earle Who was Rob Bell with? I forget.
Lee Dixon.
Someone for Lee Dixon. Yeah, absolutely. And then another 10 yards down the touchline, you had Andy Townsend and Ian Wright doing it for, I think it was for Africa or something. So they had all these little sets of TV presenters doing their thing. And in front of them all after the match were gathered crowds of different sizes. And the one around the Sky team of Neville and Carragher was particularly big. And every time they showed a replay of an Arsenal goal in slow motion, the fans would go, "Whoa, hey!" Every time it went in. I mean, I can't... yeah, exactly that. No sign of him, sadly. But, but I can't imagine that's a sustainable thing, is it? I mean, surely, you know, if Gary Neville stands out in front of a few thousand Arsenal fans, that's never going to end particularly well, is it?
It's something that probably on Friday night, given the fact that everyone was in a good mood and it was a new thing that they hadn't really expected. I don't suppose anybody really expected that to happen, that it was just sort of, oh, look at this, this is a new thing. But now, when people know it's going to happen and when things maybe don't go right, you can imagine that a sustained chant of, you know, who the fuck is Gary Neville or, you know, something is going to be problematic because that is going to happen at some ground sooner or later this season.
Andrew, are you not inciting that to happen, are you?
Absolutely not, James. I would not encourage any fans of any football team to get together and stay behind and sing songs with offensive language in it after the game simply because it would be picked up on television and be funny and they would then have to reassess the whole idea of doing these pitch side things or they have to evacuate the stadium. I'm not saying anybody should do that or organise that. I'm just saying that it's inevitable that this is going to happen.
It's out of our hands. There's nothing we could do.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's okay. Good. We cleared that up.
All right. Well, look, that was the game. That was the opening day. 4-3 Arsenal win against Leicester. I'm still not quite right after it, to be perfectly honest, but we've got a little bit of time to recover between now and the next game against Stoke on Saturday. What we're going to do now, though, is take a short break. We'll be back with questions and more in part two right after this.
Like it. Like it.
Like it.
Like it.
Like it.
Like it.
Like it.
Like
it.
Like
it.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arsecast Extra. This is part two where we answer the questions that you sent to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arseblog, and also on the Arseblog Facebook page, facebook.com/TheArseblog. James, I will give you the honour this week.
Very generous of you, sir. Well, look, I'm going to open with a question from Facebook. It's from Ollie Rodwell.
Okay.
And I alluded to this earlier, but Ollie asks, what did you think of Mesut Ozil against Leicester? A couple of good moments, but largely less effective than Xhaka or Ramsey. Would some time not being an auto-starter benefit him?
I thought he was one of those players who didn't quite play as well as we know that he can. He looked a little bit... He didn't look 100% fit to me, to be perfectly honest. Whether that was his ankle, I don't know that it can be pre-season fitness, because he played through most of pre-season. He's done all that kind of work. So it's not that he's one of those guys who's laid back and is lacking a little bit of physical preparation.
There are...
He can do amazing things, but I think we've hit a point perhaps where people are looking at some of the stuff that he doesn't do as well and focusing on that. You know, I think he could have done more in the build-up. Was it the first Leicester goal or the second Leicester goal where... I think it could have been the first one where he was caught with the ball deep in our half right. In sort of the right-back position. I think he could be stronger in situations like that. I know he's not the most physically intimidating kind of player, but, you know, he could be stronger in situations like that. But he's just got this ability to open up defenses and to provide the kind of passes that we need. Maybe he's overshadowed a bit by Xhaka at the moment, because Xhaka seems to have taken corner-taking duties from him in some ways. Certainly the in-swingers Xhaka is taking. Ozil took the out-swinger. But look, I think we got to wait and see a little bit where he is and how he performs over a few games. But to me, I would still have him in the team every week.
I think I would too. I think it's inevitable, isn't it, that this season, more than ever, his performances are going to be scrutinised. I think especially with the contract situation, as long as that's uncertain, because of his playing style, people are going to look at him and potentially question his commitment. I mean, after 70 minutes... It's kind of heresy to say it, and Arsene Wenger never does it, but I was looking at it and thinking maybe Mesut Ozil should come off, because it didn't feel like things were happening for him. Alex Iwobi's been in really good form in pre-season, and I thought maybe that's a change you could make to try and enliven things.
Yeah.
But actually, I was really surprised after that point how much energy Ozil managed to expend in those final 20 minutes. I mean, I thought he'd looked, as you say, not quite fit, not quite sharp, and yet there were times... In the last 10 minutes of the game, he was kind of playing as the lone frontman, almost chasing down defenders, chasing lost causes. He does have incredible reserves of stamina at times. And I guess that's partly what makes it frustrating when he doesn't use those physical attributes a little bit more. I didn't think he had a good game, but I think that's kind of all it was. I don't think that the solution is to drop him. I think we need him in the team. We need him to build that understanding with Lacazette. So, yeah, hopefully... He finds his feet over the next couple of weeks, because it wasn't his best performance. Funny enough, I don't know if he was on corners the whole game, I forget now, but the one he took just before the Ramsey goal, I think he might have taken that just because he had won it in the controversial circumstances that we saw with the handball, and that worked out brilliantly for us because it meant Xhaka was on the edge of the box to supply the pass for Ramsey. So it's funny how things sometimes play out. That probably wasn't part of the plan, but there you go.
Yeah, well, look, I guess it's a bit weird as well to say wait and see about a player who's been at the club now for, you know, heading into 4 years, 5 years.
True.
Is this his fifth season?
This is his I guess so, yeah. It was a 5-year deal, I think.
13, 14, yeah. 14, 15, 15, 16, 16, 17, 16, yeah. So, yeah, I suppose that maybe as well tells a bit of a story. But, like, for me, I would have him in the team every week at this moment in time, particularly, you know, at home in the Premier League against opposition like Leicester. Here's one, though, another player whose performance divided opinion. This is from KB on Twitter, who's at KB _is_on. And he says, on Twitter post Leicester, I haven't seen such division in opinions about the Ox's performance. What are your views?
There has been real division, actually, because I think on the podcast we were... a little critical of Ox after some of his pre-season performances. You know, we questioned his aspects of his delivery and his end product. And I had a few people come back at me online and say, what are you talking about? Oxlade-Chamberlain's been brilliant since he moved to wing-back. And in some respects, he has. And when he played on the right-hand side back in the spring, he was very effective. I have to be honest, I'm not sure I've ever seen him play particularly well on the left. I think even in the FA Cup final, he delivered a decent performance, but it was someone making the best of a far from ideal situation. And we all had a lot of fears about him playing in that position then. And I find it very surprising that he's started the season there. I can't work out what's going on with the Ox. You know, if Arsene Wenger wants him to sign a new contract, he's made it very clear he doesn't view him as a central midfielder. Is he playing him at left wing back so that he's giving him some minutes? So it feels like, look, you're going to be part of the team going forward. He's showing him, him his importance, because I can't believe that's the best thing for the balance of the team. I just don't think he performs well enough in that position. And actually, when he switched over to the right for the final 20 minutes against Leicester, even though he's a right back in a 4-4-2, kind of a 4-4-2, he was much more effective. I don't see it, I'll be honest, on the left-hand side. I don't think that's a position really that works for him at all.
Yeah, I would agree. Mike L on Twitter sent me some stats. He said, Ox is weird. He looked average and yet he had 6 shots. I don't think any of those shots were any good, though. 15 out of 20 duels, 4 clearances, 8 out of 9 dribbles, 3 out of 3 tackles, 3 interceptions, 2 key passes. His stats were great. And I thought, this is what confuses me. Or not so much confuses me, but gives me pause for thought, because there are so many things about him that are great. You know, the physical attributes, the ability to burst past players. I thought he did his defensive work really well. Even when he was on the left-hand side as left wing back, I thought he defended well. There was one headed clearance at the back post, which showed a defensive awareness that he hasn't always had. There were moments where he drove on with the ball, where he brought us forward. And I thought there were a lot of positive things about the way that he played, until it came to doing something with the ball when it matters. And at that point, nothing he did was any good. And I think this is, the crux of the issue for me, that he doesn't seem to be improving in that regard. The final ball, the decision-making, he gets caught on his heels at times, you know, when he should be moving into space perhaps to pick up a pass. There are just those things that when it comes to doing it in the final third, which is really, really important, I don't know that he's improving or getting any better. And I don't know whether you can say a guy played really well if he does X, Y, and Z very well, but when it comes right down to it, well, that was a shit metaphor, wasn't it? Or a shit allegory, or whatever I was trying to do there. Just the final thing, if there's no end product on top of all that, then I don't know if you can say that he played well. He did certain things well, but can you say the guy played well? I don't know. He confuses me, because he should be capable of much better at this point.
But is the game not full of very talented footballers with, you know, outstanding physical attributes who never become elite players?
Yeah.
Because they lack something almost undefinable. I mean, you even see it in youth prospects. You know, you look at a guy who's in the reserves or the youth team and you think, this guy has everything. You know, it's not the same, but if you think about someone, back to someone like a J. Emmanuel Thomas or someone like that, you think, this guy has everything, but something doesn't quite click. And is it just productivity? Is it about that clinical, that cool-headedness? Mm. Is it decisiveness? And Ox, you know, he has power, he has skill, but so does Ross Barkley. But it doesn't mean Ross Barkley is a top, top, top player, because he hasn't yet got something to his game that he needs to make that leap, to make that transformation. Maybe he won't ever. Plenty of people don't ever. That's the thing, you know. It's a gamble, isn't it? You're waiting for something to happen. Now, the problem is, we're in a position with Ox where we're waiting, and we could well lose him for nothing in 12 months.
Yeah.
And that's not... Is that wise, you know, to put your eggs in that basket and hope that this gamble pays off, when, even if it does, you might end up empty-handed?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think what we know for certain while there's a lot of uncertainty about Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, what we know for certain is that he is not a left wing back. Definitely not. Mm. I don't think that's a position that suits him. I don't think it's particularly good for the team either. He has had some good displays at right wing back, but Arsene Wenger seems to prefer Hector Bellerin in that position. That seems to be the pecking order. Maybe he'll stay and be the, I don't know, the compete for that position, but I'm not sure that he necessarily wants to. So I don't know. He confuses me. I like him. He seems a good guy. He's got a lot of good qualities, but when it comes right down to it, I think he's, at the moment, he's missing something that he really needs and should have more of at this point in his career after so many years at the club. I realize as well, he's still only 23, so, you know, there's plenty of time, but I do wonder if a decision has to be made one way or the other soon.
I mean, I think it's quite close between him and Bellerin. I don't think it's I don't think the gap is massive. You know, Bellerin would be ahead in the pecking order for me, but I think that they're good enough that potentially you could rotate. I mean, do you think it's in Arsene Wenger's mind to think, look, Barcelona are going to come back for Hector Bellerin at some point? Do I want to let this other potentially very good right wing back go? You know, when that's a risk in 1 year or 2 years or whatever it is down the line?
I don't know, maybe. Maybe, but then if Oxlade-Chamberlain isn't going to sign a new deal, which he seems not willing to do at this moment in time, then you have to make a decision based on that. That's the big decision, not something that might happen in the future, something that is actually happening now. And that's a player who won't commit his future to the club despite being offered a new deal, which he's, of course, fully entitled to do. But then you have to deal with that and you have to make decisions rather than this kind of hodgepodge thing of playing him on the left or, you know, moving him to right back when we're, you know, what's going on there? So there has to be some clarity, I think.
What does your gut say between now and the end of the window? What do you think is going to happen with Oxlade-Chamberlain?
I think he'll probably stay because I don't think Arsene Wenger wants to lose him. So, yeah, I think he'll probably stay. It's who's going to make the offer that's going to make us sell? Unless, let's say, it all starts ticking in terms of Coutinho goes to Barcelona and Liverpool have a shit ton of money and they offer us a lot of money for Oxlade-Chamberlain. Maybe something might happen in that regard there. I couldn't see us let him go to Chelsea, for example, just simply because I just don't... I'd see us more willing to deal with Liverpool than Chelsea. But at the moment, I don't see him going, but nor do I see Oxlade-Chamberlain being ready to sign a new contract. So it's just another one of those situations that we're having to deal with or manage or not manage, whatever way you want to look
well,
at it.
I'll tell you what, my next question feels a little bit relevant to that. This is from Matt Emini. And Matt says, given that we could lose Alexis, Ozil and Ox next summer, Mertesacker is retiring, and players like Koscielny and Cech will be another year into their 30s, because all of them are Real too, let's not forget. Do you think Wenger should be more active this summer, even if it means spending more money and bringing in less from sales?
Look, I think we've got a gap in the side for this season when it comes to central midfield, and I hope that we're gonna deal with that. I don't think we're gonna see any more arrivals until we move some players on. If we're gonna sign anyone else, I think it's gonna be in the last few days of the window, and it will be predicated on us moving on players like Wilshere and Gibbs and Jenkinson and Debuchy and Perez. I think we have to move those on because we've got a 33-man squad. It is, as everybody knows, too heavy. We might bring in some money from transfer fees. Not an insignificant amount, but I don't think it's going to be a huge amount. But certainly what we're going to do is take £250,000 a week, maybe more, off the wage bill, which could be redistributed then to players like Ozil and Sanchez, maybe to make them stay. But yeah, look, I think there has to be an awareness that we've got to future-proof if those players are going to leave. We can't be gambling on all three of those staying. We must be aware that there's a chance that all three could go on a free if the cards don't fall our way. So you'd like to think that there's a plan or a strategy. I don't think it's about this window, though, that if come January or February of next year, we're aware that Ox is not going to stay, that Ozil is not going to stay, that Sanchez is not going to stay, then you have to start making plans to deal with that and to bring in the personnel. But I don't see it happening during this window because we're still dealing in maybes and mights. However cynical you might want to be about those players, you know, some people say there's no way Sanchez is going to stay, and I would not put any money on Sanchez staying, but funny things can happen in football, and you just never know. We're still dealing with possibilities rather than actual definitives. But once we know definitively what those players are going to do, then we can start making plans. But it's up to the club as well to put some pressure on those players to decide one way or the other, to let us know one way or the other, because we can't lose that much talent in one window and hope to A, maintain where we are, or B, make progress. And that's what everyone wants, is for the club to make progress. But I don't think it's about this window, you know? But certainly there's got to be some long-term planning put in place, looking at the squad and going, who's going to be here, who's not, what are we losing, when are we going to lose them, and how are we going to cope with that?
Mm. I think maybe it is more about this window, just because I worry that we're going to leave ourselves with a ridiculously big task next summer. I mean, imagine if Sanchez and Ozil do go, forget about Ox. You know, that's, I don't know what that's worth in the current market, but that's £150 million worth of talent or something like that. And I don't necessarily, I worry about our capacity to do all the necessary renovations in what will be, you know, a couple of months with a World Cup in it.
Yeah, but how you're talking about what, bringing in another three or four players.
Mm.
I don't see that as realistic in this window. You know,
I don't think that is necessarily, but I think, do you not have to start that process of like long-term building for the squad, as well as having an eye on the short term? I admire the sort of short term thinking of, we need to keep these players for next season. I think that's a positive, but I worry that there's not a huge amount of thought given to what comes beyond that potentially.
Yeah, well, look, we don't know what they're thinking, but I don't think it's realistic in any way to sign another three or four players this summer where we need to get rid of five or six or seven as it stands because the squad is too big. You can't then add another four or five, because again you end up in a situation where you have unwanted players, players who aren't playing, players who are not necessarily a drain on resources, but why are you paying this guy 40, 50 grand a week if he's not going to play? Because your squad is too big, there's just no chance for him to play. So it's about finding that balance as well. So that's why I don't think it's a thing that can happen or should happen in this window, but it's certainly something that has to be addressed with some careful thinking and planning and strategy for the future. So,
yeah, but do you not think there's an example, a sort of case of which we're sort of kind of worrying a bit too much about these players that we don't want? Like, say a Kieran Gibbs, for example. He's not part of the squad at present. He's not really included in any way. I find it a little bit odd that Arsene says we've got to move these guys on first, because, I mean, why? Like, why? Like, why can't we just sit them there?
Well, because we could just sit them there, but then Kieran Gibbs is earning, what, £3.5 million a year? Carl Jenkinson earning a couple of million a year? Matthew Debussy earning whatever he was on, 80 grand a week when he came in. Lucas Perez, what, 70 grand a week? Jack Wilshere is close to 100 grand a week at Arsenal. You know, you're talking about over the course of a season, well, maybe even over the course of a week, you're talking, you know, £250,000, £350,000 a week in wages. And these guys are doing nothing. That's not a good way to run your football club. Particularly when you could use that money, A, to attract new players and pay new players good wages, players who are actually going to be in your squad, and B, use those wages perhaps to give players who actually deserve it a pay rise because they're playing every week and you want to keep them. So I don't think you can just sit those players there. And I think if you overload your squad, you just keep that cycle going where you have players that you don't want, but they're earning a lot of money, and that money then is just, you're just fucking burning it, basically. You're pissing it down a fucking hole. So,
of course, but we kind of given ourselves that problem.
Yeah, I get it. It's our problem. It's our issue through bad management or through bad squad management. So address that. Don't perpetuate it. Don't keep it going. That would be my point on that.
See, I think, of course, I see that point, but I also think that if you're prepared to go, look, our priority is the football side of things to the extent that we will kind of write off, let's say, 50 million quid as a fee for Alexis Sanchez, I kind of think you should also be in a position where you're prepared to write off the salary of Kieran Gibbs if it means you can bring in a player who improves the squad in the long term. Do you know what I mean?
Sure. I mean, I get it. But I just don't think that it's going to happen because there's too many players in the squad. I think we're stretched financially a little bit because of it. I don't think there's a huge budget left for transfers. Certainly, maybe there is more money for transfers than I think, but I don't think that the wage bill should be, you know, why would you pay an extra 25, 30 million, 40 million pounds in wages over the course of a year when you don't have to, when you shouldn't? You know, I just think that finding the right balance of players in the squad is an important part because A, it keeps it competitive, but B, it means that your resources can be better used to bring in those players that you need to improve the squad. As it stands, you know, Arsenal could offer good wages to certain players, but with those guys gone, we've got much more scope to attract better players. That's just the way I look at it.
Yeah, I mean, I would love those players to go. I sort of feel like we've kind of been so public about our desire to get rid of some of them that I don't know how much it's helping us. I mean, it does feel difficult. I'm not particularly confident that we will get what we thought we were going to get for a lot of these guys. But yeah, time will tell on that front.
Yeah,
I must say that I've got one eye on next summer, and I just think it could be a real mess. I mean, I guess, you know, short-termist thinking
is
not the worst thing.
Yeah. I do agree with that. That, like, next summer could be seismic in the sense that all those players could leave. But I think until you know definitively what they're going to do, you can't really start making plans because they will hope to keep them. They'll hope to keep Alexis. They'll hope to keep Ozil, even if that is not the most realistic or the most likely scenario. Right, here's a question. Where is it? Well, I just want to point this one out from Braden Pun on Twitter, who says, Jamie Vardy has now scored 5 times against Arsenal and been on the losing side every time. So that made me laugh. Here's a question from Brad Dennett, who's @Brad_Dennett. And he says, is the football world running out of quality managers? For example, super clubs like PSG and Barcelona getting 7 out of 10 managers.
Yeah, I don't know about PSG necessarily. I mean, Jardim, is it?
No,
PSG?
It's Emery, isn't it? Unai Emery.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I got confused with Monaco. But, oh, no. Yeah, that's right. Sorry, I was wrong. But, you know, he did really well, didn't he, at Sevilla? Am I right about that? I feel like I'm showing my ignorance here. But Barcelona, you seem to be able to just appoint pretty much anybody. I mean, again, I'm really not being clear on this, but Arsene Wenger did say that he basically thinks a robot will be able to manage teams eventually, so maybe this is just his proclamation becoming true. I don't know about if that point wider generally. Is it harder? I guess since the culture of management has changed, hasn't it? I guess in that respect, Arsene Wenger's right, and managers don't build dynasties in the same way. I think there's more delineation of responsibility, so people have less control. So I think it's probably a bit less tangible what a coach's impact is than it was previously when they had the whole running of the football club. So it probably makes it more difficult to determine the individual quality of each guy. I guess Arsene Wenger's kind of an exception in that respect.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes I think, like, this, the stature of a football club is in some ways more important than, or seems more important than, the manager. You know, Real Madrid will always be Real Madrid. They'll be a huge, important football club, regardless of who they have in charge. So, you know, same with Barcelona. You look at some of the managers Barcelona have had down the years, and they're not household names. You know, Martino, Reshak, you know, guys who were there and in charge who didn't necessarily do particularly well. The new guy, Valverde, where was he? Bilbao, was it? He was at Atletico Bilbao, I think.
I'll have to look that up for you now.
Yeah, Athletic Bilbao.
Bilbao.
So he was manager there for a while. But, you know, you look at the clubs that he's managed, Bilbao, Espanyol, Villarreal, Valencia. You know, he's a bit of a journeyman manager. But does that in any way lessen the stature of Barcelona as a football club or the expectations that people would have, fans would have, or just people who watch the game simply because they are Barcelona? They are expected to be competitive in La Liga and the Champions League. So I don't know if... the manager is as important for a club like that. Maybe it's more important for a club that's slightly bubbling under. So,
yeah, I mean, obviously, in the case of Barcelona and Madrid, a lot of it's down to the quality of the players, isn't it? It's not really the truest test of a manager. And, you know, sometimes you get a big club that does fine with a manager who then goes on to do nothing elsewhere. I mean, think of Di Matteo winning the Champions League at Chelsea and the subsequent career he's had. I think that's the thing. I think it's just harder to determine the impact of a manager in some cases than it has ever been.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe we should treasure Arsene Wenger all the more as a consequence. More so than we do, maybe.
Right.
Let's have another question, shall we?
Yes. Let's.
Okay. Let's.
Anytime you're ready, you know, just...
Yeah. Oh, okay. Back on transfers again. Antonio Fisatola on Facebook says, do you think Van Dijk is a player we should be after, as Mertesacker's retiring at the end of the season and Koscielny will be 33 next year and has a constant Achilles problem?
I do think that centre-half is an area, when we're talking about future-proofing, I think centre-half is an area that we really do need to look at because, you know, Monreal, I think, can do a job there in a back three, but is essentially a left-back. Although, you know, we've seen players like Azpilicueta, for example, flourish, who was a fullback, and flourish in a back three, and it seems to be something of a trend. But again, Monreal is a player who's in his early 30s, so not one for the long term. Koscielny, he's got that Achilles problem, as we all know, and that is going to impact his career, I think, as he gets a little bit older. Mertesacker retiring at the end of the season. Callum Chambers is not... or does not appear to have a future at Arsenal. Gabriel, you know, unconvincing at times. So you'd have worries about him. And then what are you left with as centre-halves? You're left with Shkodran Mustafi and Rob Holding and Kolasinac, who we hope is going to be a left wing-back as long as we play in this three-of-the-back formation. So, yeah, it is an area that we should be looking at. Certainly in the long term. Whether we can do it, again, we come back to whether this is something we can do this season, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that he will, because we do have plenty of options there as it stands.
About £60 million, aren't they?
We're not going to pay £60 million for Van Dijk. No way. I just don't see us using what money we have left in that area of the pitch, particularly, again, as I say, central midfield is a bigger issue for me this summer. But again, and he's one of those players, I think he's a spectacular looking defender, but one over whom I would have just a few doubts about his ability to step up. I'm not quite sure what it is that doesn't convince me about him, and I could be proved really wrong here. He could go somewhere and be an absolute stalwart somewhere else. In terms of Premier League, I think he's one of the standout central defenders in the Premier League, partly because of his size, his physicality. He's very impressive in that regard, but I just, whether that speaks to the quality of defenders in the Premier League or the quality of Van Dijk, I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I haven't watched Southampton regularly enough to have a really good read on how good he's going to be. It does sound like an insane amount of money, doesn't it? But, I think centre-half in the long term is something you want to do. I agree with you. I don't think he's going to address that this summer. Although maybe if Chambers and Gabriel were to both go, that might shift things around.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe you would need more depth there, to be perfectly honest. But,
yeah.
All right, here's a question from Lewis Freeman, who's at Ludo92. It's all rhymey. He says, given how promising Big Sead looks, I like that he didn't use his surname there, well done, who has been our best ever free transfer?
Oh, that's a good question. Guillaume Warmers. No, I don't know. who else has been a free transfer? Let's start with that. I mean,
well,
Shamak was a free transfer, wasn't he?
Yeah, that he's not it.
I
think probably the one that sticks out for me, and I'm sure it's one that people will be banging their desks, Sol Campbell?
Of course. It was so unbelievable that it was a free transfer that I forgot about it. That must be, for many reasons, the greatest free transfer in Arsenal history.
Yeah.
I can't even think of a close contender to that, to be honest.
Well, what was Cesc a free transfer? Does that count? Because he was out of contract at Barcelona, or he hadn't yet been given a contract at Barcelona, so he wasn't contracted to another club and then able to leave on a free.
We did end up paying some compensation, didn't we, I think? Like,
yeah, Giovanni van Bronckhorst.
There was a row about that. Yeah. Alex Klebb, years down the line. No, I can't think of anything that's competed with that in terms of pure value for Mali, and also how hilarious it was. Flamini, I guess. We signed Flamini on free transfers twice.
Mm.
But no comment from you there to suggest that was a good thing.
he was Flamini.
He came, he saw, he was Flamini.
I'm trying to think of any others. Was Remy Gard a free transfer?
Quite possibly. I'm just scrolling through our transfer history. I don't think there's anything to really compete with Sol Campbell. That's got to be the best one.
In terms of the impact that he had and the success that he had at the club, there isn't a better one, I think, than Sol Campbell. So
yeah, if Kolasinac gets anywhere close to that,
yeah,
he won't have done too badly.
Not at all.
Too badly at all.
Not at all.
Any further questions? I don't know if I've got any more. I'll tell you what. Well, let's deal with this. Devin Parkinson on Facebook. He says, do you think the whole Sanchez Twitter activity was really accidental, or do you think him and his agent purposely planned it? Did you see this?
This was the bizarre interaction he had with 80s hitmaker Richard Marx. Is that what you're talking about?
I think so. And the tweet was tagged from Paris. His location was set as Paris. Did you see this?
Yeah. I mean, he was at the game on Friday night. He's injured. He's got a new girlfriend. He probably took her to Paris, the city of love, to have a romantic little break. Why wouldn't you? I don't...
Yeah, well, absolutely.
What else could it be, James? I mean, what are you trying to say?
I don't know. I don't know what these people are alluding to. I don't know what he's doing in Paris all the time. He seems to be in Paris every 5 minutes. There was some chat that it was something to do with a visa, wasn't it? That he has to renew his European visa or something over in Paris? I don't know.
Why do you have to do it in Paris?
You don't have to. It's just more romantic. I don't know.
Yeah. But, but it was quite strange because the tweet was to Richard Marx, who made some terrible, terrible music in the 1980s. And Alexis Sanchez, as much as I love him as a footballer, has got very dubious taste in music. The soundtrack to some of his Instagram stories is terrible. Terrible.
He has used Phil Collins in the past.
He has used Phil Collins, but he tends to use quite cheesy music. And he tweeted Richard Marx, and then it showed up as, he said, come and play at the Emirates, come play football at the Emirates. Richard Marx said, we could sing together or something. I don't quite know what it was. And then he said, he repeated that tweet because he deleted the one that showed his location as Paris. Maybe, James, it just shows a little bit of self-awareness that he just was in Paris for romantic reasons and for nothing to do with PSG whatsoever. I think that's reasonable assumption, and then looked at it and went, uh-oh, some people might draw the wrong conclusions from this. As a conscientious Arsenal player, I do not want to further any speculation So I'll take it down and repeat the tweet without the Paris bit, and then everything's hunky dory. I think that's all it was.
To be honest, I think that's probably true. I mean, he might well have it in his mind to go to PSG, but I don't think it's going to be this summer. So there you go.
Yeah. All right, well, look, I think we'll leave it there for this week. I think we've covered the first weekend of the Premier League season. Can you do that another 37 times?
No, to be honest. I won't survive. I won't survive that. But I don't know. Hopefully things calm down a little bit. Stoke next, so I doubt it will calm down there. But, yeah, we need some respite sooner or later.
All right. Well, look, last season's visit to Stoke was a very successful one. We broke that hoodoo that had been hanging over us, so hopefully we can repeat the feat on Saturday. But we will discuss that and more in the Arsecast on Friday. Join me for that then, and James and I will be back next Monday to look at everything that goes on in the second week of the heart-stopping, butter-clenching Premier League season. Until then, have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.